Welcome to Hack Voice Radio. You are listening to us on the 30th of May 2006. Gonna have to, let's just see if we can have a four-way conversation here. I don't think it's gonna stand up to it, but we've got Dark Nature and Napalm and Goldfish here. And it's Tech Tuesday.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hello, hello.
So, Napalm, you've got some good stuff in store for us today.
Yeah.
Excellent. So, what are you going to be talking about?
Well, basically, the basic concepts of data and how a computer works. I mean, that I wanted. It's going from reverse engineering to programming and covering that whole area with hopefully, but really starting at the basics to understand the higher levels.
Mm-hmm.
So we've basically got going through assembly, registers and so forth, all the way up to, you know, reasons why you do such.
Cool. Okay. So, anybody got anything before Napalm kicks off that they want to say, talk about?
No, I'm just looking forward to hearing what he's got to say. It sounds like super interesting stuff.
Okay.
Don't keep your hopes up. Oh, dear. Right. Okay, should I start?
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. I'm just going to play this by ear at the moment. I did not have time to prepare. So everyone will have to forgive me.
That's fine, mate.
Go for it.
Right, okay, starting off, I'm guessing most people that listen would have a basic understanding of assembly, or the idea of what assembly is and what it's all about. There's a couple of websites which people should visit. One of them's sandpile.org, brilliant resource. I'm just going to visit that right now. Brilliant resource. It'll give you all the details you need to know about any of the lower level x86, 64-bit, all of that, all the new features, SSC4, all the new instruction sets that are coming out, all the information you possibly could need is on sandpile.org. It's not that detailed in explaining what the instructions mean, but it explains how OP codes relate to the machine code and so on. Another website which is really good for people to visit is FADOC. I'll type this in the RC room. Okay, FADOC.tripod.com/CPU. It's a shame that there's lots of tripod adverts on there, but the content is really good. In fact, that's where I learned, you know, what assembly actually was and really what the instructions actually did.
That gives me a 404, by the way.
Okay. Whoops. FADOC. F-A-Y. I can't type. Okay. Basically, on there you'll find index of all the A to Z index of all the instructions on a standard x86 up to SSE 2 or 3, I believe. Okay. We can go from... is anyone got any sort of subjects we want to cover at all?
I was thinking, assembly is a very powerful language to learn. It's not as difficult as people kind of go out to really think that it is. You know, when you start off, you see all this crazy, mad code, and it's all very complex, but at the end of the day, it's meant to be very simple. It's just amazingly unhumanably digestible, if you see what I mean.
I think the main reason there is that it's not really humanly readable.
It's not digestible by the human eye, as maybe some other languages are easier to digest and work out what's going on. Obviously, to start off with, once you've mastered it and you've been using assembly for quite a while, it can be much simpler. You can run through the code easily, but I was thinking, some of the kind of modern day applications would be cool if you gave some examples and stuff like that.
Right. Well, first of all, most people were interested in rootkits and other implementations of exploitation. All of these things you need to master assembly at least to understand really where this comes in. I'm getting feedback here.
Yeah, I'm just having to turn everything up all the way so that people can hear you, that's all.
Alright.
Sorry.
Okay. Okay, what are we going to do? I'm going to cover some basics. I'm guessing everyone know what bits and bytes are, so, and how they all work and everything.
Yeah.
Okay. What we're going to do... Right. 1 byte, 8 bits. 2 bytes. It's also called a word. 4 bytes. D word. Short for double word. And Q word. Quad word. And that's 2 double words. Yes, that's 4 words. These are sort of basic data. You would have basic data types stored in anything up to 32-bit on a 32-bit platform. So, if you're talking about an x86 CPU running at 32-bit, then you've got most operating codes would have 32-bit parameters. Memory addresses are all ranging within 32 bits. So you're really restricted there on 32 bits only. If you want to do 64-bit mathematics, arithmetic.
Arithmetic.
Yes. Right. You're talking about actually doing each 32 bits, and you actually have a floating point core, small subcore, which will do floating point processing. So you're talking anything like 64-bit, 80-bit, 128-bit. Right. Let's cover some basic assembly, shall we?
Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah, let's do it.
Right. Operating codes. This is really... Okay. Let's use the RC channel here. Here's some standard opcode you might see. I've just put them in a comma delimited list there.
Do you want me to call them out or?
Yeah, if you want.
So you got move, add, subtract, call, and push.
Okay, some basic principles here. Right, we have a thing called the stack. Right, and it's exactly how it sounds. It's a stack of data. You're basically saying, if you're a 32-bit CPU, the stack is normally incremented in 32-bit additions. So what? You can imagine the stack is literally a pile on your desk. So when you put data on, you put data on top and on top and on top. But you can't take something out at the bottom. Not until you take everything else on top. Okay? So it's a bit like a brick wall. You can't remove it at the bottom or it's all going to come down. Yeah?
Yeah.
Got it.
Okay. We can do some simple assembly actually on here. Registers. Okay. Registers basically, I'm just going to explain it in really simple terms. Temporal space for you to store data. Okay. There's four basic registers. We have the accumulator, EAX. There's EBX. No idea what the name is. Can't remember. ECX, the count register. And EDX, the data register. There's also segments. We're not going to get into that now. Okay. We also have interrupts. If you're talking about 16-bit, then interrupts will stop the processor doing its current processing and will switch the interrupt to its own internal table of addresses. Basic interrupts are normally stored in BIOS in a vector table. So if you're doing the DOS interrupts, it loads the system file into memory and then the vectors are set up for that. Okay. One of the famous interrupts is INT21 for 16-bit. Mm-hmm. That's the DOS interrupt, DOS system calls. We're basically saying if you want to do a function that you don't have in your program, i.e. we've got a filing system on disk and we need to communicate with it, you'd call an interrupt. Essentially, within Windows, you have the same structure, except within Windows, you do a function call as part of the Windows subsystem. That then it goes further back and does a system call into the kernel, and then the kernel does all the actions necessary. And if it needs to, it will communicate with hardware. Okay.
What about IRQs? Do you want to talk about that, or is...
Well, I mean, it's really not necessary until you're talking about OS.
Sure, okay.
I mean, if you like, we can talk about that. I mean, more than welcome to.
Yeah, I don't know, if you just want to touch a little bit upon it, because, you know, interrupts and all that stuff kind of stems off from the same thing, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can go through... you've got an application made the other day. What was it called? It's on the forum, right?
Connector, yeah.
Connector, okay. Let's just dig that out. Flood control. Alright. Have you got a link to Connector?
I do.
Can you send it over?
1 second. Right. Oh. That's not it.
You have a compiled download link on here.
Yes, it's all the way at the bottom of the code.
Okay, let me just dig that out. Yeah. Okay. Some tools. If you really want to get into reverse engineering, some tools you really need. First of all, disassembler and a debugger. Most of these things come in one utility. You've got IDA, Interactive Disassembler,
it is a commercial piece of software, and if you want it, you've got to go find it. And there's also Oli Debug, and that can be got from, I believe it's olidbg.de, but let me just get the website address for you. Good old Google. olidbg.de. Okay. What these will do, load the program into memory and allow you to view the data, data, segments of the executable, threads of execution running, the CPU context, that what I'm saying by that is that's all the registers, what their values are. You can also see the floating point registers, what their values are, and so on and so on. It also give you
fuck's sake
disassembled output of the program itself, and you'll see a lot of these opcodes. Now, they're all listed in FADOC. You'll know if you go into FADOC, the more you read, the more you're going to start understanding it. It's as simple as that. With assembly, there's some really basic concepts. I mean, move. We'll go for those opcodes we just mentioned. Move. That's move state from one place to another. That's its only job. Okay? Opcodes, also called instructions, they all more or less do one thing on an x86 platform, that is, basic x86. So we can say move data, subtract from data, add to data, push. Push is interesting. That actually pushes on top of the stack we were talking about. And we've got call, and that actually calls a function inside the program. And normally what it would do is take data off the stack and use it as parameters. Okay. Now,
just a word in from White Rat. I guess you know this person?
Yeah.
Yeah. Crackers Kit 2?
Yeah, it's a handy little set of utilities. Oli Debug, lots of unpackers. Mm-hmm. Packing is what we call when a program is, let's say, obfuscated,
mm-hmm.
and encrypted, or protected in some manner. The idea is that you take the original application, which can be simply disassembled, you can see the assembly code, you can understand how it works by looking carefully enough. Whereas if it's packed, you're literally seeing unpacking code and lots of data. That's it. So you can't get directly into the program.
Right.
Okay. It's basically just a level of obfuscation to stop you from getting at the original source. Yeah, the assembly listings. It's only job, a packer. Protectors, on the other hand, they make your job a little bit more difficult. They stop you from debugging applications, they stop you from changing memory, there's CRC checks, all sorts. But we won't get into that.
So basically, just to make sure that nobody else can fiddle with the
your
code.
Compiled application.
And it kind of checks its own self and makes sure that everything's in the right place and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
I can also understand why software developers might want to do this. Obviously, protect their
revenue.
Revenue stream. at the end of the day, no one can. Well, it makes it very difficult for people to find flaws in the software, maybe report flaws.
Mm.
That's good and bad. We both know the size of size there.
Microsoft.
and of course, that's my train of thought there. There's a couple other bits of software in there. Things like the unpackers that'll take the packed code, convert it unpacked,
mm-hmm.
and so you'll basically have a EXE file. We're talking Windows here only, okay?
Yeah.
All of this.
Yeah, by the way, this is all Windows stuff.
Well, the same applies to the low level as on Linux.
Sure, yeah.
if we're talking about the kernel and so on, then I'd rather go into Windows than I have more experience in Windows than Linux. So.
Yeah.
Still, the basic principles apply. Now, the question is, do we have any questions from anyone? Or anything like that?
Yeah, any questions from anyone who's listening right now, please put them through to us. I don't know if there were any replies to the threads that I put out in the forums. Let me just check.
I didn't see any, I don't think.
I guess one of my questions would be, let me see. Somebody really goes out and says that we've had recently in IRC is, you know, I want to crack CD codes. In the most respectful way, how would you answer that question and not saying, you know, fucking Google it or you're a noob, you'll never get to that kind of point. But what would really be the procedure? You know, what would you have to do?
Well, first of all, as I say, these basic concepts of understanding assembly, these are fundamental to trying to crack any sort of code. Okay, you've got a program, let's say it's a game.
Yeah.
Okay, at some point it asks you for the serial code, the CD key, whatever. Yeah. It will have to validate that. And by doing that, it will do different types of sum on the content of the serial.
Yeah.
Normally, maybe just checking certain bits of data in the right places. If it adds the first part to the second part, they add up to a certain number. There's lots of methods that are implemented. And to find out these methods, and to find out how the CD key is constructed, you need to look at the assembly listings of the program. So to sort of find this information, you would need to put the program through disassembler and debugger sort of, yeah, like IDA, which will show you cross references in code.
Hmm.
That's basically where you have a call op code. Right, that will take you to another point inside the program.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, that's cross referenced back. Okay, so you can say when you're at the address of the destination of the call, you can see where it's calling from.
Right.
And there might be several places which this one function is being called, so you have a list of cross-references. So, within Windows programs, you have imports. Now, imports are basically functions inside Windows which the program uses. You need to understand what these are. Really what each function that you're importing is and what it does and how it functions. Now, that may seem difficult, but we're really just talking about a general idea,
mm-hmm,
of i.e. what sort of values it returns, maybe. So, there's MSDN for that. There's msdn.microsoft.com. Type in the function name in the search facility on the website, and you'll be able to get up a listing of what the function is, what the parameters are, and so on and so on and so on. Once you've found something, okay, we'll take, should we make it up a imaginary example program?
Yeah.
Okay, just I'll much better type this up and put it on the forum for people to have a look at. Okay. Let's say the development house, or the company that made the software, they've got a way of taking someone's name or email address or maybe a start and end date of a license and generating from that information a code. Now, that's generally sort of a serial. In the case of a CD key, there's a generalized method which makes up lots of different keys, but they all result to the same thing. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
The idea is different starting values will cause a different end value, of course. Same thing, input, out. Yeah? Okay, should we take a game CD key, for example, and I'll do like a little example application?
Sure, let's say, you know, a game like, I don't know, Duke Nukem Forever.
Duke Nukem Forever. I haven't even seen that.
Well, it hasn't come out yet, so that's how, you know.
Well, it hasn't come out yet.
That's how elite you have to be to crack it. They haven't even coded that bit for verifying the CD key.
Or is it out on PlayStation and stuff?
No. It's like vaporware.
Oh, okay. Okay. Right. So, at some point in the program, it's going to ask you to enter the key. At this point in the program, what you want to do is what we call breakpoint, or pause the execution of the program. Basically, what it is, it's like stopping the program in a current instance in time. You're saying, this is the point of the program it's at, and this is where it's been, and this is what it's done before. You can't see what's going to do in the future, though. Okay? It's not a time machine.
Yeah.
Okay. So, first of all, entering the CD key. What we need to do, we don't enter a key in, or we could, and break afterwards. Pause the program in execution, and then look at the what we call the call stack. Basically, that's all the return addresses. Okay, just so I'm going to actually explain this. When you do a call, there's an instruction called RET, R-E-T, that returns to the address after it was called from. Yeah. So we have call, call stop function. There'll be a RET at the end of the function, which will return back to the address after the call. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the call stack is literally, it'll give you a list of all of the calls and their return addresses. Okay? All these debuggers have that. It's a generalized feature. Okay, each, just so that you know, each thread has its own stack that also encompasses the call stack. You trace the callback stack until you see something inside the program. Okay, then you know you're out of sort of the Windows code, so that's sort of like the DOL files, yeah, link libraries.
Yeah,
you're out of you know we're in Windows code. Yeah, you're back to where the program called the original Windows function.
Mm.
Okay, and you can see what function was. Most probably sort of like you know generating a message box on the screen or something like that. Okay, then you have to look, if we haven't entered a key in, we have to look forward and find out the return data from the function, how it's being processed.
Right.
So, we break point, we type our code in, we break point there. Now, basically, place a break point is basically placing a place to pause the program. So, what we then do, start the program back up, we now got a break point after we've accepted input. Type in the key, it'll break point straight afterwards, and it'll show us the context of the CPU.
Mm-hmm.
This is all the registers, what their values are. It'll show us mostly the stack and where we are inside the program, and including assembly listings. You'd have to trace through. Now, tracing is a generic term, basically means looking through code. It's that simple. Okay. Tracing normally involves going step by step. That's when you press, there's actually a key in OLLI, I believe it's F8, and that'll take you to the next instruction, and it will show you in red in OLLI, it will show you the differences to the registers, i.e. what's been changed, yeah?
Yeah.
So you can step through the code. Now there'll be at some point, you'll find that it's manipulating that data that you entered, or it calls a function with that as its parameter. This is really where you've got to look in detail about what it's doing, and OLLI actually allows you to comment any line, any address of assembly listing. You can then say what that's doing and how it relates to the code itself, i.e. if the code's in segments. You can say this relates to segment 1, character 5, so on and so on. Once you have it all commented, you can then read through the comments, maybe go...
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah, we got cut off, so I think you were talking about...
Yeah. Okay, back to what it was. You're tracing through the code. Now you've commented it. You now need to look through, maybe reiterate through the code, so that's where you continue execution. In order to debug that, pressing F9. It will show the error box saying it's invalid code or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
You reiterate through the code. So you enter another fake code in, or hit your breakpoint. Once you have that breakpoint, you have to look through it and see what it's doing. Now, there are some points where it does what we call jump. Now, you've got a non-conditional jump and a conditional jump. That basically, really simply means, a non-conditional jump means it has to do that. It has to move to that point inside the program. It's not the same as a call, because it does not return. Okay? A conditional jump, on the other hand, you'll find there's something previous which alters what we call the flags. There's a section in the CPU context called E-flags, and in there we have carry flag, parity flag, zero flag, and these are all set on a check. So, for instance, you do a compare between two different things. Yeah. So we'll just say we'll compare the first character of the CD code, and it has to say J. Okay. Now, as you know, J is a character, but it's also got its own representation in data, one byte, and that's what you call ASCII codes. And there's a nice useful website. I'll just type that in. Okay, lookuptables.com, mm-hmm. Or I think it's another useful one, ascii-table.com. And the link's the same domain, whatever you can remember. Okay, ASCII table. It's really simple. On the website there, you've got columns, decimal, hex. Decimal, hex. So, if we look up J, we'll use capital J for instance. That's decimal 74, or 418 hexadecimal. So, in this type of program, you might see something like it moves from a memory address, which is where it stored the key you typed in. It moves the first byte, which will be move into AL, for instance. Okay, so move AL, comma, byte point, pointer, and then the memory address of the beginning of the key. So that moves the first byte into AL. So you've got that in AL, then you're going to do a comparison. Yeah, so you can small opcode instruction, CMP. Okay, that does literally a direct comparison between the two things you specify. Okay, so it would say compare AL to 4A, for instance. Okay, that's J. Alright, and then below that, it will just have something like a conditional jump. Conditional jump will be something like J and Z, which is jump if not zero, JZ, jump if zero, and literally these just check the E flags. And on the E flags in Ollie, you'll see if it's set to zero or one. Yeah, so jump if not zero, it's set to zero, and jump if not zero, it's set to one. It's literally on off. Yeah, you with me, Bilal there?
Sorry,
with me?
I am with you.
Okay. Okay. It's so at one the following code in the listing, you'll see there's one segment which you'll see in the code, it'll show you the strings and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see it says like invalid code or something, and successfully entered code, thank you very much. And it continues on with the program and does the registration and whatnot. It alters this, that, and the other inside sort of like files for the program to make it registered, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You'll have jump if not zero. Right, which will say if the first character is not J, yeah?
Right.
Now jump down to the segment of code which says unsuccessful, please try again or whatever. Yeah? Then the following code after J and Z. Now what happens if we have a fall through, where that's where if the jump isn't taken, it literally falls through to the next instruction. Okay? The next instruction carries on with something like, thank you, you successfully entered your code. This really basic, okay?
Yeah.
Now, what you'll normally find, instead of trying to edit this code or anything like that, you take it one step behind. As I was saying, normally you'll find there's a call somewhere which to some function with the parameters, the serial code you entered in, or something like that. Now, it has to return if it matched, or if it failed the serial check or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's going to return maybe a Boolean value. Yeah. So true or false. Zero or one.
Yeah.
Okay. So what happened is, in the assembly listing, you'll see call function, underneath that, compare EAX, which is your normally the accumulator variable, register, which contains the return code from using a rect instruction. So you have something like compare EAX to 1, compares it to false. If it's false, then jump to here, show unsuccessful message. Otherwise, fall through and show successful message.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. These are really basic things. As you can see, it might look really complicated. At the end of the day, in the program they made, program language they made it in, let's say it's C++ or something, they might have several different classes in there, several classes accessing objects, that access this, accessing sure. string that, and all this other, you know, dereferencing and quite useless things in the low level. But at the end of the day, it's always going to come down to some small point where the program has to check one thing or the other. Yeah, there might be several checks. Yeah, if all three checks are passed, then it jumps to a certain point in the program, which carries on and says this is successful and so on. Yeah.
So basically, in a sense, you kind of bypass that and tell it that, oh, no, it's fine, don't worry about it.
Yep, sorry, I didn't explain. Once you've understood the code and you see what it's doing, you can then decide if you want to patch it or not. And basically, in Oli, that's really simple. Double-click on the assembly line, yeah, the operation.
Yeah.
And you'll get a box up saying you can edit it. You just literally type, for instance, JNZ to JZ or something like that. And you literally just change the code on the fly in memory. You can carry on the program, press F9, and see if it's made a change. These are really basic techniques. I could go into depth, but it's going to get really confusing if it's not already. A couple of things that I wanted to talk about. One was that reverse engineering, it's not just maybe getting past protections or something like that.
Yeah.
You're also talking about the benefits of reverse engineering, being able to understand code to such a low level that everything above that becomes simple. The thing is, because everything has to be compiled and brought down to the low level to run the CPU, that therefore means that everything above the CPU level, i.e. assembly level, is abstract. Yeah? You with me?
Yeah.
So therefore, if you're dealing with an object, in C++ you see it as maybe an item, a block on the screen with its variable content, so this variable that, this variable this, and so on, with its what the variable's values are, and so on. Now, yeah, you see it like that, or you see calling one function inside an object, for instance. Now, in assembly, you can still view that same what you did there in C++ in assembly, but you're not going to see it like that. You're going to see pure, the raw essence of it, the data. For instance, the functions themselves, when you create new objects in C++, you don't make a copy of all the functions. The functions remain where they are. They're static. Yeah. You make a small structure. Basically, it's just a list of data.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a reference to the class in memory. Basically, it's going to have a reference to the original object in memory.
Fucking hell.
The base object. You're going to have maybe a reference to how many objects have been made of that type, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
You'll then have pointers. Now, I don't know if anyone's covered pointers, but it's literally a pointer contain. It's the same as any other value, same as if you had a D word with a value of, I don't know, 200,000 in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's literally just a number. And basically the number represents a memory address, okay? So a pointer is literally a value of a memory address in the program. Okay, and you'll find that inside this object, for instance, you've got several different memory addresses and they all relate to functions inside the object.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you make a new instance of that object, you're literally making a copy of that object, but it's just pointers to the data. Yeah. And then when you bring it down to even lower level, that means there's no sort of object orientation when you're doing assembly. You know, there's no sort of call this function and this object. You're literally just calling it data itself. Yeah, you're calling a function at this point in memory. It's not like you're dealing with this, that, and the other. You know?
Sure.
It's hard to explain.
So you've got about 20 minutes left. I was wondering, do you want to talk a bit about buffer overflows or anything like that?
Oh, we can talk about that if you like.
Yeah.
Okay, buffer overflows. Okay, we were talking about our fellow friend the stack earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Buffer overflows normally are stack based. There's lots of different types of buffer overflows. We're going to talk about the stack ones. Okay. Also, you can also call it stack overflow. Okay. Let's think of an example program that I can do later. Okay, simple really. Takes two strings it's a console application. Shows enter your name, and then after you've entered your name, it takes that input, calls a function, which may be. It takes your input of your name, first name, takes your input of your last name, and then concats the two together, places your last name after your first name, and then outputs it on the screen. Yeah?
Yeah.
Simple little program, nothing major. Okay. Now, the data you're entering the screen, that's got to go someplace. Now, everything on the computer, it has to know how much data to allocate to something before you can use it. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You can't say, I've got an infinite amount of space to use, because on a computer, that's impossible. Yeah? What you can say, though, is say, I've got 200 bytes of data on the stack, and I'm going to use that for entering my first name. Well, that's a bit ridiculous, 200 bytes, I don't know. Whatever, we'll say, I don't know, 20 bytes. Okay. Now the point is, inside that, you're calling the stack runs, I'm just going to, it's really hard to explain, the stack runs backwards, right. Okay. The stack has a limit to how much data it can have. It starts address high in memory, and every time you add something onto the stack address is actually removed from something is removed from the stack address. So, like let's say 4 bytes after you add something to the stack.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, the free space in the stack gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller.
By however much you put into it.
However much you put into it. Okay. Now, as I was saying earlier on, when you do a call, it has to be able to return. Now, for the return instruction to know where it needs to go to, the call instruction places the next address after it onto the stack. Okay? Before the function is actually executed. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, 4 bytes on the stack are the return address of our function we're in at the moment, yeah? Inside that function, we take the input and we put that into buffers. Okay, now inside that function, we allocate 20 bytes on the stack. So that means if you were to try and visualize this, on the stack, we've got 4 bytes, which is our return address.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got 20 bytes, it's in reverse, so we've got 20 bytes reserve space, and then afterwards we've got our 4-byte return address. And as you can see, this sort of like, if we were to put more than 20 bytes in, we would go into the return address space, yeah? So we've got 24 bytes there. First 20 is our buffer, the last 4 bytes are the return address. Okay?
Okay.
So what you can do with a stack overflow, if you put malicious code into the buffer up to 20 bytes, you can then put your own return address, yeah?
Did you read that?
Yeah, I just read that. Yeah. Okay, so you can actually overwrite the return address. So you overwrite return address with the position stack your code is located. So what happens is when the program executes, it copies wherever you entered, not your name, actual code, into that buffer and overwrites the return address. Then what happens is it continues executing until it needs to return. And what's going to happen is it's going to use that return address and jump into the buffer itself, yeah, where your code is located, mm-hmm. and execute your code. Yeah? So the actual control flow is taken from the original call into the function itself, puts stuff onto the into the buffer,
mm-hmm.
overwrites the return address, and then when it decides to return, that return address is used, and it goes into the buffer itself, and actually executes that code. Now that code you went into the buffer has to be slightly formulated differently.
Mm-hmm.
We're basically
it's hard to explain 20-foot whiteboard.
It's not just that I can hear myself talking, which is really difficult.
It's not the best conditions.
Okay. The code inside that buffer. Now, a lot of these functions, for instance, if it's inputting a string, strings are simply bytes of data, and they use the null terminator, right? Basically, the last byte has a value of 0, and that tells it where the end of the string is.
Yeah.
So what happens is that means if you want to put code into that buffer, you can't put zeros in there. Rather, it's just going to think the string ends at that first zero. Yeah?
Yep. Sounds good.
So what happens is you have to formulate your code as such that you don't use any zeros in it. And then, of course, you can position... Let's say you've got a 200 byte buffer that you can put code into. You can put up to 200 bytes of code into that buffer. Now, when I say code and bytes and so on, this is actually machine code. Each operation code, i.e. move, add, sub, call, so on, they all have a number of bytes, and those bytes have specific values depending on what they do. So I'm just trying to think any off the top of my head. We've got, well, rect, C3, that's what it is in hex, one byte. You've got call, there's several different machine code, that's, you know, with the raw data. Thanks, Dark Nature. Okay. And again, these bytes, again, they have different values, you've got different call types, you've got a long call, you've got a near call, you've got, well, it could go on. But you've got, I think it's E9 and E8. It's a near and long call.
So basically, what you're trying to say is that if you were going to code that in, you would actually have to write it in hex. You'd have to write.
But you would write it in hex onto the screen, for instance, when you enter your name, because again, you're actually typing keys on the keyboard, which are represented by ASCII.
Sure, but if you were gonna write malicious code into the buffer, you'd have to do it in machine.
You'd need to write your program.
Yeah.
Take the machine code of that program and get it entered into the buffer.
Yeah.
And to do that, you either write your own little program,
mm-hmm.
or if you're lucky, you can get away with typing it in. And when I say typing it in, on the Windows-based machines, you can actually type. You can hold down the Alt key. And type the decimal value on the number pad. Yeah?
Yeah.
You can type non-printable keys, where you can't type in the keyboard using that method. So let's say out of the ASCII set, one of the high characters, 147. So you'd hold down Alt and press 147, and you'd actually have that come up on the screen. Exactly. Believe it's a French O, one of those weird things above it. Yeah.
An accent.
And you can... Yeah, an accent. That's the one. Okay. Now, you, anyone can do that in any program in Windows. It's a generalised... There we go. White red to tell you. E9 long jump, E8. It's a call. There you go.
Corrected live.
Anyway. Well, that. Anyway. Other thing, I mean, you can make improvements to existing programs.
Mm-hmm.
Again, a program, what you might see on a Windows machine, a file which ends in .exe, at the end of the day, all the data that needs to start the program executing is inside that file, or inside files it accesses. So, at the end of the day, you can modify that file in any way. You can change, you know, a byte in a file, just as if you were to edit a text file. Yeah, for that you need to use a hex editor. Or, in Olli, you can actually edit the code, yeah, so edit your assembly, and you can actually select your edits, right-click, write selection to, write edited selection to disk or something like that, and it'll actually make a new .exe file with your changes, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Other things you can do, like your connector we were talking about earlier, you can actually modify that to use a different port, for instance. Yeah? I can actually put down as an example, if you like. It connects to a default port, right? Is it just HTTP?
Sorry, the...
No, your connector.
Yeah.
It doesn't use... What ports does it use?
Oh, any port. You can set any port.
It just opens it.
So, 0 to 100,000, whatever the LUT port limit is.
Okay.
Yeah. So let's say you wanted somebody to listen to port 666, and somebody else to connect to port 666.
Yeah. Okay, but your connector, let's have a look here.
You've got about 7 minutes.
Okay, your program is 46 kilobytes. Now, that's fucking huge for assembly program.
Sure it is, yeah.
And I can tell you why. Your little bitmap.
Because I've got
a
huge bitmap.
That bitmap for the top.
I love it. It took me like three seconds to do in a paint shop, and I didn't have any consideration of obviously dropping it down to a nice little gift
your
size.
Your bitmap is 40.5 kilobyte.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's taken up literally the whole content of the program. Okay. What you could have actually done with that is actually written inside the program a little bit of code to actually write that on the screen.
Yeah.
Those words.
Yeah.
And of course that's going to say the ASCII string, 20 bytes. Maybe the code to actually get on the screen. Maybe another 50 bytes. So 70 bytes.
Yeah.
Or 40.5 kilobytes. Yeah. You can see the difference there.
Sure.
Yeah. But of course, that means it's hard-coded in there, and it can also means that ASCII inside the program can be changed, so it reads, for instance, connector version 66.6, napalm.
Awesome.
Okay.
Cracked by napalm.
So what I'm going to just quickly do here, your bitmap has very limited colours in it. So, it's a 24-bit bitmap. No need for it to be that.
Sure.
I'm just going to say it as a 16-bit. 16-colour, sorry. Okay. Now, the size of the bitmap's down to 5.25 kilobytes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now it's a definite reduction. Yeah? So, and that can be overwritten inside your program.
Sure.
I'm just going to do that now. I'm going to place these on the forum. And how I did it as well. Okay. Your application is now reduced down to 11 kilobytes from 40. Now, these reductions aren't just in small programs in nature. You're not doing anything else now, just a little bit of talk, games and such like. They're coming sort of like, you need at least 5 gig of disk space.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, exactly. What are they thinking? These games can definitely use less no idea what happened there.
Never mind.
I blue screened, believe or not.
Oh, damn it. Napalm got owned.
Yay!
So, you were saying programs these days could be much, much less fatter?
Has Bill Gates got shares in Skype?
I think that's probably why you blue screened.
Anyway. Yeah, no, I mean, there's no real need, as far as I can see, I've examined a lot of these, that they can't reduce their code base a definite amount and actually have their programs a lot smaller. I mean, there's lots of lossless data compression, formats out there. So, I mean, it's not like they can't, use uncompressed JPEGs. I mean, a lot of them are a lot smaller than what they would be in bitmap format. I mean, as we just did an example there, 40 kilobytes for your small little bitmap at the top there.
Sure.
You know, less colours, it's down to 5. I mean, you can still do that lossless JPEG, and still sort of, you're still going to maintain all of the colours, all of the levels of detail. And you're not going to have a problem there. I mean, okay, load time increases slightly, but at the end of the day, you've got to weigh off differences there, yeah?
Hmm.
When you've got we've all got fast computers nowadays. If you're playing games, top range 3D games, your computer's going to be powerful enough to run these games.
Hmm.
You're going to see this noticeable difference of using JPEGs instead of bitmaps, for instance.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the same is encompassed for audio as well. Was there anything else?
We're going to have to round things off now anyway.
Okay.
We've got a few minutes left. So, yeah, thank you for dropping by and doing the Tech Tuesday. It was very interesting to touch up some things that I've forgotten, and I'm sure some people have learned
a little bit
and maybe given them a little bit of a spark to go out there, and you've given some good sources and quotes and stuff.
Well,
Of links to kind of check out.
I mean, I know you're going offline now for a little bit.
Yeah.
On the radio station, so.
Yeah, we're going to be closing the season off tomorrow. So I guess we're going to have 3 weeks of no radio. But in the meantime, we're going to be working on the Hack Mag. We're going to be working on various things, and I'll let you finish your sentence.
Well, I was just going to say I can carry different bits on the forum if people prefer.
Awesome.
So
cool.
If people want to, are interested in reverse engineering, I can carry on, put examples and so on.
Yeah.
Get some learning in there.
Yeah. That would be very cool.
Also, and I'd be more than willing to contribute to the Hack Mag.
Excellent.
So, it's all good.
Cool. Well, thank you for tuning in, and thank you for dropping by and doing Tech News Day.
That's right.
Napalm. Shouts out to Team ICU, you Leeds Hacksaws, and I'll see you tomorrow for the last show of the season. Good night.
Little shout out here for
White Rat.
Good friend Typhoon.
Yeah.
And White Rat himself.
Excellent.
Tune into DJ XO, bassdrive.com, London, UK. If you missed the-